Good morning. This case, as the court knows after having read the briefs, arises out of a settlement, at least they call it DRSA, dispute resolution settlement agreement that was entered into by claimants, then attorneys Lees, Morelli, and Brown with Nextel Corporation. There's opposition that the, under Rule 1.7 of the professional code, that the that agreement is non-consentable, and we believe that the trial court judge erred when he made the determination that the issue of consent was a matter that ought to go to the jury in this case. We think that that decision by the trial court also impacted on his later decision to determine that Nextel was to be dismissed in this case, because we believe that once the court made a determination that the agreement was consentable, was a consentable agreement, then the only issue left was whether or not the general release that was entered into by Nextel and the plaintiffs in this case was a valid general release. We believe that if, in fact, this court makes a determination that the underlying agreement itself was not consentable, then the court could also make a determination that the decision, the trial court's decision to dismiss the aiding and abetting claim against Nextel, which we believe was at least in part based upon that erroneous decision that the agreement was not consentable. We believe that they mesh together. We believe that one kind of leads to the decision on the other.
Mr. Richardson, let me ask you: has any Colorado case decided how the code of professional responsibility is to be treated as an element of proof in a malpractice case?
You know, I'm not aware of a case that does that, but I do. One thing I did want to bring to the court's attention, and I think is somewhat analogous to the decision that we're asking the court to make in this case, concerns a ethical opinion 115 that dealt with somewhat similar circumstances, dealing with an ADR alternative dispute resolution agreement. I guess the committee in that case kind of characterized those as, sorry, but my vision is getting poor and this lighting isn't the greatest, collaborative and cooperative law contracts. And under the facts of that case, the facts under the premise that they reviewed, they determined that that type of agreement, I guess the difference, maybe I can just kind of summarize the difference between that agreement and this one, was that it involved the parties similar to this case. They also arrived at an ADR agreement, but ethics committee determined that ADR agreement also said that once the parties agreed to that, if in fact the ADR agreement was not successful, then the attorneys would not be allowed to represent that particular class in any subsequent litigation.
Let's go on for just a second, if we could,
sure.
To follow this line of my question. If the code doesn't define standards of liability in malpractice cases, and it's not binding on courts, and doesn't have the force of law, how can the trial court properly instruct the jury with jury instruction on the code?
I think the code does have persuasive effect. It does not have any conclusive effect. It doesn't bind the court. It doesn't bind the trial court. The trial court makes its own determination, as can this court. But I do believe that it does have some persuasive effect, assuming, you know, with regard to what the standard ought to be. I think we talked about the standard of care for lawyers. And I've read cases, and I can't cite one right now, basically indicating that the trial court can consider that as part of its determination of whether or not the applicable standards were met.
So it's discretionary?
Well, I think it's persuasive. I believe it's persuasive testimony to the trial. It can be persuasive in any event, but it's not binding on the trial court. But I do believe that in this case, if you look at the conflicts that kind of inherent in this DRSA agreement, and I said, I'm sure the court has read some of the statements that we've indicated that we feel show a conflict, and we believe that 1.7, one of the comments to that states that loyalty to a client is also impaired when a lawyer cannot consider, recommend, or carry out an appropriate course of action for a client because of lawyer's other responsibilities or interests. I believe that this agreement on its face, which basically gives the lawyers an incentive, the defendant, the Lees, Merrill, and Brown, it gives them an incentive to terminate this case promptly, I mean quickly, without the clients having, and also it gives them, and I think the latter part of this consultancy agreement to me is just one of the things that I'm not sure if anyone here, I've not seen anything even similar to that, that basically gives them an incentive to cut this, to settle this case in a prompt manner. And if the court looks at the DRSA more closely, you'll see that if in fact all of the individuals in the case don't arrive at an agreement in a prompt manner, the consultancy agreement is subject to being terminated. The consultancy agreement would start at the time that all of the 587 individuals had completed their settlements. Then the two-year consultancy commences at $83,000 a month. Now, that amounts to about approximately, almost exactly $2 million over a two-year period of time. We believe that gives them a financial incentive. They gave Lees, Melly, and Brown a financial incentive, which we think violates their duties under Rule 1.7, and certainly the comment to Rule 1.7. It violates their duties because it gives them an incentive. Their interests are not corresponding to the interests of their clients. And if the court also looks at the issue of consent in this case, there was obviously no informed consent. I don't think we need to even get to that issue because we believe that it's a non-consentable agreement.
Now, pardon me, Mr. Richardson, pardon me for interrupting you. Please. Let's assume, just for purposes of argument, that we agree with you that this may have been a non-consentable agreement. Nonetheless, your clients, represented not by LNB, settled with Nextel. So they got something that they agreed was sufficient out of the lawsuit with Nextel. Because of that, what was their theory to recover anything from LNB at trial?
Well, I think that, excuse me, Anna. We believe that if the agreement itself provided that my clients would not have the opportunity to select any other counsel other than Lees, Merrill, and Brown. It is opposition. I think that if you look at the facts of this case, my clients were in a position at the time that they entered into this to settle this case for $15,000 each of them, at the time they made that decision, it was not, I mean, if you look at the general lease makes it appear, you know, under no duress or any of that, but I think that the pressures that were placed on my clients at that time, they really didn't have a choice. They were basically forced to either do that or nothing. That was, at that point, that was a clearly a dispute between my clients and Lees, Morelli, and Brown.
I don't think I made my question clear.
I guess maybe I didn't understand.
And I apologize for that. But how were they harmed? Did they establish a trial that if they had not settled and if this agreement had not come into existence, that they would have gotten more money?
I think evidence was presented at trial with respect to their damages. Now, I think that's obviously something that would have had, I'm not sure if it ever, obviously no decision was made into that respect, but I'm sure there was testimony presented with respect to their damages, that they think that they suffered as a result of how they were treated, the underlying case, as to how they were treated by Nextel, the discrimination they suffered while they were at Nextel. There was evidence presented about the damages that they sustained. Obviously, in view of the decision by the jury, that they never got to that because they decided that basically my clients had consented, I guess implicitly in their decision. I believe it stated that their clients had obviously consented to the agreement. So if I understand your question correctly, I believe that there was something that evidence was presented in that area, but it was something that no determination was ever made because of the jury's findings.
Mr. Richardson, allow me to ask a unrelated question, but a procedural matter. As you're aware, there is a conditional cross appeal in this case.
Correct.
Against both of your clients. And as I understand it, Ms. Moore has filed for bankruptcy protection under the code. And although she's requested that it be dismissed, there has not been an order, has there, from the bankruptcy court dismissing the bankruptcy?
No, there's not been any order dismissing the bankruptcy, but there, and the bankruptcy trustee they're aware of this case, and they haven't, you know, indicated to me that they wanted to substitute someone else or take any other action with respect to this appeal.
You would agree, would you not, that under the case law, at least in our court, we would not consider the appeal with respect to Ms. Moore at this point?
I guess my understanding, and I guess I'm not so much a bankruptcy lawyer, is that the trustee in bankruptcy, once the case is filed in bankruptcy, the trustee has the right to substitute himself in pretty much any pending case.
I think the trustee in bankruptcy does have a right to substitute, but if you take a look at Way Architects against Rock Rimmon at 140 P3rd 12, you might understand why we will not proceed with respect to Ms. Moore in light of the fact that we have cross appeals that are conditional.
I understand, Your Honor.
All right.
If there are no questions, I'll reserve time.
Yes, sir. You have 4 minutes and 11 seconds.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Mike McConnell, and I represent Leeds, Morelli & Brown. The primary issue on appeal for the plaintiff, the appellant, is that the DRSA created conflicts of interest that were not consentable, that valid as a matter of law, a conflict could not be validly waived.
Mr. McConnell, excuse me for interrupting,
yes.
But have you and counsel for Nextel come to some agreement about how you're going to split your time?
We have,
today?
10 and 5.
Okay, great.
Despite making the argument that as a matter of law the DRSA could not be validly consented to, the plaintiff has cited virtually no law in support of that proposition. The only law that they have cited is Rule of Professional Conduct 1.7. And Your Honor, you asked the question of what sort of evidentiary impact the rules would have in a legal malpractice case. In this trial, what actually happened is that a number of experts testified. They testified about the rules of professional conduct as evidence of professional standards, and there was no objection to them doing so. Both sides' experts did that. As I'm sure you know, in 2000, effective January 1st, 2008, there were significant amendments to the rules of professional conduct. One of the amendments was to the scope, and in that amendment it said that evidence of violations of the rules of professional conduct can be evidence of a violation of a professional standard. That, I would submit, illustrates that the district court here approached this case appropriately, and that is it treated the issue of consent as a matter of fact, not as a matter of law. And all of the arguments that the plaintiff makes about the DRSA not being consentable were factual arguments made to this jury and rejected as a matter of fact. Every single one of them was made to the jury, articulated by the plaintiff's expert, and the jury concluded, based on a jury instruction 14, to which there was no objection made, that consent was valid. So based on that alone, we would submit that the plaintiff's primary argument that as a matter of law, the DRSA could not be, was not consentable, has to be rejected. Now, there are certain types of representations that as a matter of law cannot be consentable, and there were significant amendments to Rule 1.7 effective in 2008, and the structure of consentability was altered a little bit to align more with the restatement approach, approach set out in Section 122 of the Restatement of Law Governing Lawyers. And one of those provisions deals with representations that are prohibited by law. An example would be that there are some federal statutes that prohibit government lawyers, former government lawyers, from representing criminal defendants in certain types of cases and that type of thing. No one contends here, and the plaintiff has cited no authority, that the issues created by the DRSA were prohibited by law. no authority is cited that prohibits the consultancy provision, the fee arrangement, or any other aspect of the DRSA as a matter of law.
Well, Mr. McConnell, you mentioned the 2008 amendment as to the scope of the code. Weren't all the matters that were considered in the trial court here matters that took place prior?
Yes, absolutely. I'm just pointing out that that's the after this, or effective after this trial, was adopted prior to this trial, but there was authority in other jurisdictions that permitted the rules to be treated as evidence in legal malpractice cases. Colorado did not have any such authority at the time of this trial. There had been the rules, the amendments adopted, they just didn't go into effect for a couple of months after this trial, so that the approach the court took and the parties took without objection is consistent with the current state of the current scope provision of the rules of professional conduct.
I'm just trying to determine how the trial court could have made either an error of law or abused its discretion in coming to the conclusion that as a matter of law, this is something that could be consented to, when I don't see in the record that anyone tendered instructions that would have allowed the jury to somehow connect the dots between the standard of care for malpractice and the code of professional responsibility.
That's an important point, because the issue in this case, or the claim that the DRSA, the conflict issue, relates to is a breach of fiduciary duty claim. There was expert testimony about the fiduciary duties of lawyers under these circumstances, and the fiduciary duty of a lawyer, which the rules of professional conduct may inform but don't absolutely govern. And so there was expert testimony, as in any other professional liability case, about the professional obligations, the fiduciary obligations of lawyers. One of those is to make adequate disclosure and obtain the client's informed consent. The court simply instructed the jury, since there was expert testimony from, there was testimony by some experts, that they did not believe the DRSA was consentable, that as a matter of law, if there was adequate consent or adequate disclosure and informed consent obtained, then that consent could be valid. So it was treated as a matter of fact, I would submit appropriately, as it would in any other breach of fiduciary duty claim, because the fiduciary duty was, in essence, defined by the court or under appropriate instructions, and then the details of what the fiduciary duty was described to the jury by experts for both sides, and then the jury, as in any other professional liability case, made that decision as a question of fact.
Mr. McConnell, would it be would you think of any kind of an example where a financial incentive type conflict would be non-consentable as a matter of law?
I can't off the top of my head with the I suppose if the other side was paying a fee that was contingent on a favorable outcome to the other side, perhaps that would be. But that, I mean, that this flat fee arrangement in an employment case simply took the normal structure of employment civil rights cases, where there is a fee shifting provision under the civil rights statutes in Title VII and so forth, and placed that into a flat fee at the beginning of the case. It included costs, so there was evidence at trial that there were over $2 million in costs incurred by Leeds, Morelli, and Brown. So I would submit that under the circumstances and the evidence in this case, that it clearly was a fee arrangement that could be validly consented to, as any other fee-shifting provision can be. It needs to be disclosed, there needs to be a conversation, and it needs to be consented to. I think it's important to understand, too, the evidence that was submitted to the jury about the disclosure process, because the Leeds, Morelli, and Brown consulted with one of the leading ethics experts in New York, Professor Roy Simon from Hofstra, who's written the leading text on the New York rules before the DRSA was entered. Nextel consulted with Jeffrey Hazard about the ethics of the DRSA before it was ever submitted to any clients. So this was vetted prior to its being submitted to any clients. And then a disclosure process was set up where there were small group meetings with clients around the country. The DRSA was reviewed provision by provision by lawyers from Leeds, Morelli, and Brown with those clients. There were three documents prepared that were evidence exhibits at trial: the individual agreement, the pledge of good faith, and those were signed by Denise McNeil and Alencia Ashton Moore, the plaintiffs here. There was a structure for a disclosure process created by Leeds, Morelli, and Brown based upon ethics, the advice from ethics experts set up to assure that clients obtained informed consent or provided informed consent. And those, there were clients that decided not to go through this ADR process defined by the DRSA. So I've agreed to allow Mr. Hoffman 5 minutes. I don't want to eat into his time. Thank you.
Mr. Hoffman, do your fortunes rise and fall with those of the law firm here?
No. Dan Hoffman for Nextel, and with me is Anthony Giacomini, sitting at my table, from Riley Posner. This case has an air of insanity about it, if for those that lived with it. Let me point out three facts first that I think are critical. One's already been mentioned by Judge Bernard. The plaintiffs knew everything about the DRSA. They helped train people about the facts of the DRSA. They went to Georgia and California with LMB and talked about the DRSA. It wasn't simply signing something. They were intimately familiar with the DRSA. Two, they concede, the plaintiffs concede, there was no wrongful contact by Nextel after the termination. There is no wrongful contact, fraudulent, negligent, intentional, or otherwise wrongful after the termination. There simply was no contact between Nextel and the plaintiffs. And finally, as Judge Bernard observed, or at least asked in the question, there is no evidence that there would have been damages in excess of the $15,000. And as a matter of fact, the plaintiffs testified that they took the $15,000 because the arbitration was going to be uncertain. I believe that's almost a quote, the use of the word uncertain. Those are critical facts. They signed the individual agreement, which acknowledges that they had looked at the DRSA and were familiar with it. The individual agreement says they are aware of the fact that they won't have to pay a contingency fee of one-third of the recovery. And instead, there would be a fee paid to Leeds, Morelli by Nextel, and they knew the amount of that from their knowledge of the DRSA. They knew that there was going to be a consultancy. They knew there was a conflict of interest created by the consultancy, and that they expressly waived that conflict. They knew the amount of the consultancy from their knowledge of the DRSA. Summary judgment in October of 2007 is interesting because the reply, or the response to the summary judgment motion by then counsel, Mr. Paul Gordon, was a reference to literally hundreds, I hope I'm not exaggerating, of pleadings. It's Read all this stuff. Somewhere in there, you'll find that we've addressed these issues. That's basically what the response was. Judge Stern, who had then taken the case from Judge McMullen, said, the response you've given me is simply inadequate as a matter of law. It tells me nothing about what your position is. It is a morass of just simply incorporating stuff. And I'm granting the summary judgment because of the inadequacy of the response. But I will nevertheless go over the as if you had properly objected, the merits of each of the arguments you make, the 1.7 conflicts issue, the 1.8 payment by a third party issue, all of the rules of conduct were treated as evidentiary issues, which I believe is generally held to be permissible in cases that have addressed that issue. It's not binding, but it's certainly an evidentiary fact, as Mr. McConnell pointed out. And there was no objection, by the way. Neither side, as Mr. McConnell pointed out, objected to the references to rules of professional conduct, nor their references as such in instructions 13 and 14. But that's the jury trial, and we were out by that time. They signed a release. The release says we were not pressured. We made the decision of our own free will. We understand we're giving up all our rights. There's a small point in the Kaiser case on page 17 of our brief that I probably should have made more significant, which is they are suing us, Nextel, but they're keeping the benefits that they got, the $15,000. The Kaiser case, which I think is a 1999 Colorado case versus Market Square, says you can't do that. You can't move to rescind a contract, to set aside a contract, and keep all the benefits. Also refers to Trimble versus Kavar in that regard. And I was counsel in that case for Trimble in my younger day. But under all those facts, it is hard to see why there's any possible claim against Nextel. The case is about whether or not you can waive the consultants. That's what the case is about. And we had Rich Hennessy as an expert. I think he's been chairman of the Colorado Ethics Commission or Board. Justice Dabowski. This is the litigation stage. They had experts on their side. McMim, an experienced trial attorney. Paula Greeson, an experienced trial attorney. The judge concluded it was waivable if there was reasonable advice and information given, and the judge ruled that there was.
Thanks, Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Richardson, I'm going to give you a little extra time. I let Mr. Hoffman go a little long. I'll give you 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. One of the issues brought up by both counsel concerned, I guess, the issue, the matter of evidence that was actually presented during the trial itself. Obviously, once the court made a determination, I think they made a comment, they were making, I guess, several comments about the fact that this, no one objected to the evidence presented with regard to the expert testimony. Based upon the trial court's ruling, I think they had no choice. The trial court basically said that it was consentable. So after that point, all that evidence was going to be admissible. It wasn't as if they somehow waived anything by not objecting to that testimony, because based upon the trial court's order, that was the issue to be determined, whether or not that was consent, actually.
Well, Mr. Richardson, with respect to Nextel, how do you respond to Mr. Hoffman's point that you keep the benefits, but you ask for a rescission of the agreement?
Your Honor, I'm familiar with some of the law on that issue also. I do believe that my clients, I don't think that precludes them from filing a lawsuit. And in any event, that issue was not something that I, from my review of the record, it wasn't something that was brought, that was raised before the trial court, or at least certainly there's no order or no decision rendered by the trial court concerning that. I think that's something that, if in fact they felt that was an appropriate argument to make, is something they certainly should have made to the trial court, and had it, and you'd have, the court would have something to review in that regard.
Can't we affirm the dismissal on summary judgment grounds for on any basis?
I guess any basis in the record, Your Honor. But I guess my position is that it's something that they've waived. And I think if they've consciously chosen, elected to waive an argument, that's something the court certainly doesn't, certainly could honor that waiver and basically look to other issues with respect to whether or not, at least how this appeal ought to be determined. Another issue concerns one of the things I did want to, I guess, bring to the court's attention also was the fact that there was an admitted conflict of interest. I think if you look at the highlights and if you look at the individual agreement, both Lees, Morelli, and Brown admit that there was an inherent conflict of interest with respect to the consultancy agreement.
Well, that's not the issue here, is it? The issue is whether or not it could be consented to and waived.
But I think that certainly applies. One of the things, if you look at some of the comments issued by the comments to the to the rules of professional conduct, one of the things they basically say is you look at each individual case to determine what is consensible or what may be determined to be consent. I mean, there's even a definition of informed consent at the beginning of the rules, and I think that in this kind of a case, if you start with the assumption, or at least with the fact that there's an inherent conflict, then I think there's a higher standard that's required for them to prove that there's been some sort of a consent. And I think the consent in this case, the only written consent that you'll see in this case, will be the highlights and the individual agreement. And if you look at both of those documents, there's nothing in either of those documents about the five. And they mentioned that their clients are going to be, that Lees, Morelli, and Brown are going to be paid some amount, but I think it's significant that they omitted the $5.5 million figure.
But Mr. Richardson, if I may interrupt, that may have been the case for a variety of the clients in this case, but apparently your clients were in a special position because they were employees of LMB, and they talked with people about this agreement. So the inference is that they were intimately familiar with it. And thus, doesn't that cut against the argument you just made?
I think there's an argument that they were. I think they claim that my clients were given copies of the agreement. In fact, they were given the highlights. And my clients were advised all of the other folks concerning the highlights, what they were given. The agreement itself was they somehow obtained later on. They did not obtain the agreement directly from Lees, Morelli, and Brown. This is something that was concealed. What they obtained from Lees, Morelli, and Brown were the highlights, and they obtained the individual agreement. They, based upon the information they were given, they did consult, but it's our position that they did not know of all the specifics of the agreement. Also, if anyone looks at this DRSA agreement itself, this agreement is highly complex. My clients were not, I think you look at the record in this case, you can certainly realize they're not sophisticated folks who are going to understand that. And it's our position that based upon you looking at that agreement and based upon the fact that there was an admitted conflict, they had the, Lees, Morelli, and Brown had the absolute duty to present a very specific statement showing all of the possible conflicts and allowing my clients to have an informed consent to that. And I believe that, obviously, that whole issue was the matter for the trial court, but we do believe that in fact, it kind of shows the difficulty that my clients were facing when you're dealing with an attorney that you've retained and that you have to retain because the agreement says you can't fire them. And I think that's another inherent, inequity with respect to the DRSA.
Thank you, Mr. Richardson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel for your excellent arguments. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes our docket for this morning, and the bailiff may announce a recess.